We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Former Speaker of the Massachusetts House, NPR's Tovia Smith reports Sal DeMacy has been convicted of taking $75,000 in kickbacks.
In an emotional appeal, DeMacy called himself a broken man who'd lost everything, but accepted responsibility for his mistakes. They say the road to hell is paved with good intentions, he said. I don't want to go to hell, and I certainly don't want to go to prison. Prosecutors are recommending 12 and a half years. Defense attorneys called that too harsh and asked for 3, but U.S. District Court Judge Mark Wolf seemed unswayed. DeMacy is the third consecutive speaker of the Massachusetts House convicted of crimes, leaving Wolf to wonder aloud who is more dangerous, criminals selling drugs, or those, quote, conspiring to sell public office. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
Then I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, celebrating 20 years of being a source for what works in education. More at edutopia.org.
Programs on WILL are made possible by Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This Sunday, an NPR News special, coverage of the 10th anniversary of 9/11. I'm Audie Cornish. Join us for memorial services from Ground Zero, the Pentagon, and Shanksville, Pennsylvania. We'll also report on how the day is being remembered around the country. That's special coverage from NPR News, the 10th anniversary of 9/11.
Sunday morning from 7 to 1 on AM 580 and from 7 to 10 on FM 90.9.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Well, we're sorry to say that we were not able to make contact with the guests we have scheduled for this morning, Dr. Lewis Friedman from the Planetary Society, where we are going to be talking about the future of the space program. I'm sure we can get that rescheduled for another day. What we will do here is reach into the archives, and we have found a program that at least has something of a celestial connection. This is a conversation that I had back in August of 2009 with Christopher Kokinos. He teaches at Utah State. It's an interview about a book that he wrote that looks at people who are fascinated by meteors. So that's what we have for you here, hour number one. So as you listen, do keep in mind that for the first hour here, we'll not be taking calls. Well, although humans haven't always understood them exactly, we have at the same time long been fascinated by the rocks that fall from space. And this morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll profile some of the people who have chased meteorites and turned their study into a science. And our guest is Christopher Kokinos. He's author of a recently published book. The title is The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars. He says that while they might not be much to look at, meteorites contain hints to the origin of the solar system, and that's why it is that scientists study them so intensely. The book is published by Tarcher Penguin. Our guest is both a nonfiction writer and a poet. He writes about science and nature. He's the author of the book Hope is the Thing with Feathers, which looks at extinct bird species of North America. He's won a number of awards for his work. He's professor of English at Utah State University and has contributed to a number of different publications. His writing has appeared in the LA Times, Orion, Science, and Poetry. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. Well, Christopher Kokinos, hello.
Hey, good to be here. One other thing you left off my bio.
Yes.
I'm a huge Chicago Bears fan. So.
Oh, well, excellent. That's one more great point, your favorite. Well, and also, you're a Hoosier. You were born in the great neighboring state of Indiana.
Yeah, that's right. I grew up as a Bears fan, so I always have to explain that to people when they say, aren't you a Colts fan? No, it was long before the Colts came to
back. Yeah, back in the day, there were no Colts in Indianapolis.
That's right.
Well, I appreciate you giving us some of your time. And I think that clearly here in the book, what you're doing is profiling some people who have been fascinated, one might say obsessed,
definitely.
By meteorites, people who have really been bitten by the bug, and I think that you were too. What is it you think that is so compelling about these things?
Well, you know, they're just rocks on the one hand, and I think for most of us, they're, you know, rocks are things that we get them in our shoes, you know, they chip our windshields, and so on, you know, looked at that way, they are just rocks. But on the other hand, they're just rocks that come from space, and they're 4.6 billion years old. They're the oldest things that you can touch with your skin, and if you know even just a little bit about them, and you know, I'm an English person, I'm not a scientist, but in my journeys and learning about these rocks, I came to appreciate that even though they are visually often not that interesting to look at, they are seething with information, as you said, about the origins of the solar system, about life and death on the planet. There's a rich folklore associated with meteors and meteorites. And in profiling the characters who become obsessed with these things, I found that these rocks also teach us a lot about ourselves.
If there are a couple of ways that meteorites are discovered, I think that some people are lucky enough to actually see them come down and then try to go to the place where they land.
Right.
But there are a lot of meteorites that have been sitting where they're sitting for a long time, and someone comes along and sees them. Now, if we were walking along, particularly if we, I'm talking about me, if you're an untrained observer and you look down and you saw a rock,
yeah,
would there be anything about it that would draw your attention or that would say to you, there is something about this that's special?
Right, right. You know, what? This is a weird rock. What should I do with it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There are a few things to keep in mind, and there's some great resources online and at local natural history museums and at universities that will help people in just casually looking for these rocks, these meteorites, or if they're really serious about hunting them. And a few things that you might keep in mind, one would be, is the rock, you know, different from the surrounding rock of the country, and that's one of the first clues. They are often magnetic. They often have a brown or black surface. Fusion crust is what the scientists call this, where the rock, as it was passing through the atmosphere, you know, the surface of it melted a little bit because of the heat of the friction there as it's, you know, dashing down to the planet. So there's this kind of patina that looks a little bit like desert varnish, if people are familiar with that. But that's another way of looking for meteorites. Is it heavier than an ordinary rock of that same size? That's another test. If it has holes, it isn't a meteorite. But if it's heavy and dark, and you know, it looks different from the surrounding country rock, has some magnetism to it, then it's a good bet that it's at least worth investigating.
Mm. Joe, if you were interested, there is a relatively short checklist that you could have in your mind so that if you saw something that particularly caught your interest, you could say, okay, does it satisfy any of these things on my list? And
right,
if so, then you might say, well, that could indeed be a meteorite.
Yeah, absolutely. And a couple other things there, too. They often have these little thumbprints or sort of indentations from the uneven heating and uneven melting as it falls through the atmosphere. So that's another good sign. The interior of meteorites typically is lighter than the exterior, so that would be yet another. And if it's an iron meteorite, which are the ones that I think stand out the most because they're significantly heavier for, you know, terrestrial rocks of the same size, and if you can just sort of scrape a little bit of the surface off and you see a shiny shiny interior, I should say, beneath that surface, that's nickel iron, and that's a really good sign that it's a meteorite. And quickly, before I forget, the other thing to say is that you can't just take them, you know, and call them yours. If you're on private property, they belong to the landowner, and if you're on public property, you need to notify the agency that owns that property.
Mm-hmm. They come in three broad categories, and I understand that scientists spend a lot of time trying to figure out what they're made of and classifying them. But basically, we have stony meteorites, iron meteorites, and then something that's a mix of the two, stony iron meteorites. What exactly is the difference between those three?
Well, I like to think about these categories not only in terms of identification, but If you can visualize an asteroid, if just visualize this small, you know, rock in space, big enough to have an iron core that's melted, like the larger planets, like our planet, and over time, that iron core cools down, and we're talking millions and millions of years, and it becomes solid. So that's the source of iron meteorites. And then the surface, or the crust, is the stony source, the source of stony meteorites, and then the mixing zone between the two. So there's kind of an onion model when you think about these things. And the main constituent of meteorites that distinguishes them from Earth rocks is nickel iron. And all three categories have nickel iron in them to varying degrees. And then beyond that, you know, there are all these other elements that are in there, some that are familiar to us, you know, because they're in Earth rocks as well, and some that only occur in rocks from outer space. One of the forms of stony meteorites is called a chondrite, and one of the chondrites category of a chondrite is carbonaceous, which is, as its name suggests, full of carbon. And those rocks were hitting the atmosphere, hitting the primordial planet 4.6 billion years ago, in seeding our planet with carbon and water and amino acids that occurred only in outer space. So they're an interesting, you know, mix of the familiar and the strange.
Yeah. I expect that some people listening to us will have seen shooting stars.
Yeah.
And that is what here we're talking about. That is a meteorite before it has landed. That's what we're talking about. And just recently, we've actually come through one of the big periodic showers, the Perseids. So in fact, maybe some people have seen them.
Yeah.
At the same time, I would expect that most people would think that meteorites were kind of rare and special. And while they indeed may be special, they're actually not that rare.
Well, they aren't. It's kind of paradoxical. I mean, they aren't and they are. I mean, they aren't because they're falling all the time. Mm-hmm. And every year, every square mile of the planet gets about 8 new meteorites. So they're landing all the time. A lot of those are very small, okay? That eight new meteorites per square mile per year figure includes meteorites that are only a gram or more, right? So a gram is a pretty small object. So they're common in that way, but on the other hand, I mean, how many of us have gone out and, you know, seen a meteorite, seen this rock that's landed from outer space? And so I think there's that interesting tension between how much a part of the cosmos they are and how rare it is for any one of us as individuals to actually encounter one in the wild.
Yeah.
And that sort of sparkle of attachment and obsession is part of what drives the characters in the book. But you can go out and find these things. People do hunt them, and you can locate them, you know, and it becomes a part of a subculture of collectors and dealers and scientists, of course, who are studying them.
Yeah. I think one of the things that might really surprise people, given how bright shooting stars can be, is how small the thing that's causing that really can be.
Yeah, indeed. They're quite small. You mentioned the Perseids, and if you happen to see a meteorite, you know, fall at your feet, which would be great, you know, during the Perseids, then it's not a Perseid, because that particular meteor shower, and most meteor showers, are the tiny debris of former comets. And so those are, you know, basically grains of sand. And an object about the size of a raisin will produce a huge fireball. So these very small objects, and they're coming into the atmosphere, you know, between 7 and 44 miles per second. So they're going very quickly. They heat up very fast, and they often don't survive. So the meteor shower stuff is tiny dust grains that are burning up quickly. And then the larger meteors that come in and drop meteorites are either slowed down by the air, or they're so big that they, you know, they'll explode and they'll drop those meteorites down to the planet.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Christopher Kokinos, is author of the new book, The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars. Tarcher Penguin is the publisher. Questions welcome. And in fact, we have a caller ready to talk with us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Savoy, line one. Hello.
Good morning. I have three little points here. Is the only difference between a meteor and a meteorite the size?
No, it's just a really a matter of location. When they're in outer space, we call them meteoroids, basically smaller versions of asteroids. And then, as David was suggesting, the light that's passing through the air, whether it's a big object or a small object, that's the meteor, that's the shooting star. If it survives to land on the planet, then we call it a meteorite.
Oh, thank you very much. It sounded like you were describing something that was scorched on the outside, and I'm guessing that's simply because it went through the atmosphere.
That's right.
Okay. My last question is, I saw something on PBS TV recently. I think it was a replay, so I can't really tell you when it originally came out, about the extinction of the 60% or 40%, I forgot which it was, of life on the planet, which took out the dinosaurs, and it was supposedly all related to a 6-mile-wide meteorite that hit the Earth. Are you familiar with that story at all?
Oh, absolutely, and that's the best documented extinction event associated with a cosmic impact. And I talk about that a little bit in the book. With that story, with Hollywood movies like Deep Impact and Armageddon, I think we associate these big rocks falling from outer space entirely with, you know, death and destruction, and they do cause that. So 65 million years ago, a huge impactor, and I guess there's still some controversy as to whether it was an asteroid or it was a comet being, you know, kind of a dirty snowball of ice and debris and so forth, and an asteroid or meteoroid being a more solid object. And again, it could be made out of stone or iron, and that affects how much, you know, force it delivers to the planet. Mm-hmm. But it hit off what is now the Yucatan Peninsula, caused a devastating global extinction event. And there's still some discussion within scientific circles about the immediate impact, so to speak, of this object. Did that kill off the dinosaurs immediately, or did it cause a chain of events, you know, in terms of affecting the climate and so forth, and the extinction might have been slower. But in any case, the dinosaurs were wiped out, and the small, insignificant little critters running around the feet of the dinosaurs, called mammals, were then able to evolve, and here we are. So in a way, we have this giant impact from space to thank for our being here today. And that point, the fact that meteorites can, in fact, have a positive impact on evolution, at least from our perspective, if not from T-Rex's perspective, I think we sometimes forget that.
Yeah, so that's a very good description. They weren't around to eat us up, as it were. what was the mineral that was in the crust that they've been excavating? Do you remember that mineral that... it's very sparse on the planet, but there was so much of it in that layer they figured it came from outer space.
That's right. That's a good question. It's called iridium.
Iridium.
It's a rare element on Earth, but it's a good tracer for a cosmic impact. And so it's one of the things that scientists look for to identify an impact event. They look for an iridium layer. Now that particular element isn't always going to be there in huge quantities, and that makes for some interesting discussions and debates among scientists who are looking at potential impact events. So, for example, there are some scientists who have argued that there was an even bigger impact event at 250 million years ago at the end of the Permian. The Permian was the biggest, you know, wipeout of life on Earth. About 90% of all the species on the planet were destroyed. And it's a classic debate between, you know, did volcanoes do this and, you know, other terrestrial climatic sort of events, or did an impact do this? Did the impact, you know, cause these terrestrial events? And finding an iridium layer has been a little bit difficult with the Permian impact argument, and that seems now to be, you know, on the ropes, as it were. And so it's not entirely clear that an impact caused this event at the Permian, but that iridium layer is a good smoking gun for a lot of impact events.
Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes I read or see something that traces something like this to supposedly the formation of the Gulf of Mexico. Is any of what you've described connectable to that, or is that still
tectonic event? Yeah, I don't know if the Gulf of Mexico predated the impact 65 million years ago or not. I presume it did, but off the top of my head, I don't know.
Okay, well, I have one last comment, and then I'll ring off here. It sounds to me like, on the one hand, if this thing was 6 miles wide, that's a really big rock.
It is. It's a very big rock.
But when you think of it in terms of the continent at this location is a little over 3,000 miles wide, 6 miles wide is not very big.
Yeah.
But if 6-mile-wide rock can cause that, then that's... tells us something. I don't know exactly what, but it tells us a great deal, because when you consider the width of the continent, 6 miles is not very big.
Yeah, well, and when you consider the size of the planet, 6 miles is nothing. But it's it's again one of those paradoxical things about rocks coming from outer space. We can jog 6 miles, right? I mean, that's nothing. But these are coming in when they're that big, the atmosphere will just not slow it down. And they're coming in, as I said, between 7 and 44 miles per second. If it's made of iron, it's a very heavy rock. It produces a bow wave in front of it, pushes the air out from in front of it, blasts a hole in the ground, and sends an amazing amount of material up into the atmosphere. And about every 90 million years or so, an object about 6 to 8 miles wide will hit the atmosphere, and it releases 100 million megatons of force, which is enough to cause a global extinction event. Now, we could scale it back down and kind of put this in a more human perspective, because that's almost unimaginable. That every couple hundred years, every two centuries, an event the size of the one that caused Meteor Crater in Arizona takes place. That was an iron meteorite that was only 150 feet wide, and yet it hit, 50,000 years ago, and caused a devastation over 100 square miles. 150 feet causing that much devastation, and we're talking about coming in 45,000 miles per hour. And it caused winds that were supersonic. It literally sucked the air out of the lungs of animals. So even these smaller events can cause an enormous amount of devastation. Imagine something like that hitting New York City.
Well, just to I want to thank the caller, by the way, just to continue with that for a second. And I know probably whenever you talk, you have to deal with people asking these questions about, the giant rocks smashing the earth and bringing an end to life as we know it.
Yeah.
At the same time, however, I know that there are at least some scientists who think, well, it would be very important for us to chart bodies that are out there in space that we think could pass close enough to the Earth for there to be a threat. So
yeah.
That at the very least, we ought to know where these things are, so that if it's possible that their orbit would bring them close enough to the Earth to cause a problem, we would know that enough in advance so that we could start thinking about what we might do. And there are a number of scenarios for dealing with that very thing. I think just recently I've read an article that said something like that the resources that NASA was devoting to this business of trying to chart these objects was just not up to the task, and that there was no way with the resources that they had they could actually do the job.
Yeah.
Is that a problem?
Well, yes, it is, but I wouldn't put it entirely on NASA's doorstep, although, the budget, I would say, is in fact inadequate. NASA is, I'm a fan of NASA. I'm a fan of space exploration, both robotic and human. And, that's an agency that's basically been in perpetual crisis since the end of the Apollo program. And so, no, they don't have enough money. But there are other surveys going on. There are other, searches for these asteroids, potentially hazardous asteroids or near-Earth objects or near-Earth asteroids. You sort of pick your terminology, and as of a couple years ago, surveys had found about 900 of these potentially hazardous asteroids. So the surveys are continuing, and they need to continue. And this is one of the areas in which actually you know, regular people can contribute and do what we call citizen science. So if you're a stargazer, if you have any interest in this and you have a telescope, you can also be a part of searching for asteroids and looking for, you know, these rocks that may have our name on them. So that's I think, an important point. This is something we can contribute to as just regular folks. You don't have to work for NASA or be an astronaut. But then the other part of that question is, you know, what do we do if we find one that will intersect our orbit really closely, or we see one that's coming in? And there are different scenarios. The Bruce Willis scenario is, you know, makes for good Hollywood spectacle, but, you know, it's just not a really good idea to take a big rock in space, blow it up, and have a bunch of other rocks falling on the planet. So there are some less dramatic ways to deal with this, such as putting a probe over an asteroid and letting the small mass of that probe alter the orbit of that space rock just enough that it wouldn't, you know, hit the planet. And there's a group headed by Rusty Schweikert, who's a former Apollo astronaut, called the B612 Foundation, and they're looking into things like this. And so if you're interested in you know, what we would actually do, that's a resource and a group to look at. The other thing I would say is there's an argument here to be made for making the species a two-planet species, because eventually a global extinction event will happen again. And do we want to be, you know, strictly on this planet when that happens? So another way to think about it.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Christopher Kokinos. He's author of a recent book that's about the fascination that people have had for a very long time with meteorites. The book is The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars. That's the subtitle. Targe Penguin is the publisher. He's also the author of the book, The Hope is the Thing with Feathers, A Personal Chronicle of Vanished Birds. His nonfiction reviews and poems have appeared in a number of places, including the LA Times, Orion, Science, and Poetry. He's professor of English at Utah State University. Questions are welcome, and we have some others. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Next is the community of Belgium, not too far away here. Line 4, hello.
Hello, and good morning. I may not have quite all my facts right, but it seems years ago I went up to the Field Museum in Chicago, and they have a little display of a meteorite that went through the roof of a barn and into a Model T of something. And they've got the asteroid, pardon me, the meteorite sitting right there, and it's, oh, I don't know, about the size of your hand, a baseball or something.
Uh-huh.
And you're talking about these 6-mile ones or 150-foot ones hitting the earth at a gazillion miles an hour.
Right.
Why didn't that one make a hole that blew up the guy's Model T and his barn and everything else?
Yeah, good question. And that's a great story. I remember, I can't remember what town that took place in, but I do remember that meteorite. It's because a lot of them, well, I mean, the really big ones are rare, you know, the giant 6-mile wide ones, as I said, you know, every 90 million years. On the other hand, every day we get meteorites of about 13 pounds hitting the atmosphere, about 5 or 6 of those every day. So on the smaller end of things, they're more frequent. And when they hit the atmosphere, if they're small enough to be slowed down, but big enough to survive, eventually the air will slow it down, so it's just basically falling under the influence of gravity. And so you're not that Model T was not hit at, you know, 44 miles per second. You know, a couple hundred miles per hour maybe tops, or even less than that. So they do get slowed down. And that's why when meteorites hit, they frequently don't cause craters. I mean, they'll punch a hole into something. They'll punch a hole into the soil or into your car, but they're not going to cause a huge impact event. And I would say, too, that those meteorites that hit something, the dealers and collectors have a particular name for that. They call them hammers. And they love to collect the objects that have been hit by meteorites. So, gosh, I can't remember now. Was it 3 or 4 years ago up in Chicago in Park Forest, Illinois? There was that fall of meteorites, and the dealer community, you know, descended on Park Forest, and they were buying not only the rocks, but computers, printers, window shades that have been hit by these things, and spending, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars to collect these objects that have been hit by meteorites. Like, I can hardly imagine what that Model T would go for if it ever left the Field Museum. It would be a very pricey collectible.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thank you for the call, and let us continue. And the next person we'll talk with is in Piatone, and this is line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. You know, I was wondering, all this bit about, you know, that the end of the world, a lot of people out there are starting to push that agenda, thinking that the next biggest asteroid or meteor is going to be out there. And realistically, my father-in-law works for NASA. There's not a darn thing they can do about it. And the thing is, I want to point out to people, though, out here, is that do you want to spend billions of dollars in doing research on this and developing something that would push a rock away? That's my question. And the other thing also is NASA. I think NASA's done a pretty decent job on launching space shuttles, and we've only lost two. If you consider all the other countries in the world that lost people when trying to do the same thing, I think we've been fortunate. But my question would be, with all the development they have now, I mean, there's a lot of things that we do that NASA, that we've built on and made and produced, that NASA itself has basically produced up there.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do next? Do we keep NASA afloat? Do we keep giving them money, or do we tell them to cut back on certain things, or what? Is NASA, to you, is NASA a viable entity, or should we leave that up to the private industry? And I'll get off and listen. Thanks.
Well, a couple of things to say. I mean, you know, the threat to civilization from a rock falling from space is, you know, well, let's put it in context. I wouldn't add it to my list of things to worry about right now, as in, you know, what am I going to worry about on Friday? But they do happen, and it will happen again. So, but it's a long-term thing. It's a long view sort of question. Every million years or so, well, there's an asteroid impact on the planet that would be big enough to potentially wipe out human civilization. So that's a much longer time scale than, say, you know, congressional appropriations. So the debate or question about, you know, do we do something about these? We're not spending that much money on dealing with surveys for asteroids that could hit the planet. And I don't have that information directly in front of me. So it's a very small amount of money. And private groups and private individuals, as well as governments, are interested in ways to deflect these things. The larger question, it's not really anything I get into in the fallen sky, but since you raised it, I mean, you know, NASA's budget is minuscule compared to the federal budget. It's about 1% of the federal budget, and I know there's some questions about what happens after the space shuttle is retired. Just one county over from where I live here in northern Utah is ATK, which is the company that's helping to build the new rocket, the Ares rocket, and they test those things out in the desert. You can drive over there and watch this huge rocket, strapped down, of course. It's not actually being launched, and see the motor fire. It's very impressive, but it's also, to me, it's always been kind of an interesting metaphor. It's this huge, impressive, you know, display of power, but the rocket isn't going anywhere. So I think we need to think about what NASA might do next, and there's talk about going to the moon. I personally think that the effort to have the next human spaceflight program focus on actually going to asteroids would be much more interesting. We've never been to them as human visitors. I think it would be dramatic. I think it would capture the public's imagination. So I hope that happens. And I think, you know, if constituents out there feel one way or the other about the role of NASA, they should just, you know, let their elected officials know.
Yeah. Just for a moment here, we were talking before about meteoroids and rights, which is the subject of your book. The asteroid has come up, and I think essentially the difference between these two things is just the size.
Yeah.
Asteroid is much bigger. Meteoroid is smaller. But
yeah,
maybe your reasons for being interested in them would be the same. So let me ask you to talk just for a little bit about the scientific value of meteorites, having them and studying them.
Oh, absolutely. Well, they're called the poor man's space probe. I mean, that's one of the cliches you hear at scientific meetings that discuss meteorites. You think about, we've never been to the asteroid belt, but it's coming to us. You know, we've only been to the surface of the moon a handful of times, but rocks are ejected off the surface of the moon, and they come to us. We've never landed a human being on Mars, and yet, you know, a meteorite hitting Mars with enough force will eject some of the Martian, rocks off that planet, and eventually, through the vagaries of gravity, they make their way to planet Earth. So we basically have a sampling mission going on just by waiting for these rocks to fall and by going out and hunting for them. One of the things I did for the book ends with my going to Antarctica with a group of scientists. And Antarctica, it turns out, is one of the best places to find meteorites on the planet because they get trapped in the ice, and then that ice, will move as, you can imagine a glacier moving, and the ice will get, bound up against a mountain range and stop moving or slow down, and the wind strips it off, and then here are these rocks, here are these meteorites from outer space just waiting to be picked up. And we pick them up because they tell us about not only the formation of the solar system, but they tell us about other stars, because there is interstellar material that has been embedded into these meteorites, interstellar material that was part of the formation of our solar system. So there, too, without having mastered faster-than-light travel, we don't have the Enterprise to go out to, Alpha Centauri, but other stars exploded, and they seeded our solar system. So scientists look at these things and find interesting clues about the formation of our solar system. One of those clues, and it's, I think, a fascinating little story, is these little glassy beads called chondrules. And they're, if you can imagine a little BB of glass that's been caught up in a meteorite. So they were once very hot. These little glassy globes were once melting. And they get caught up in meteorites that have never been melted before. And this is a mystery. And scientists aren't quite sure how they formed or how they got caught up in these unheated meteorites. But one of the things that seems pretty clear about these little glassy beads, the size of BBs, is that they helped the planets form. Because dust and material, will sort of clump together like dust bunnies under your bed. But at a certain scale, it tends to shred apart in the violent sort of atmosphere, or I should say the violent space of a solar system being created. So what held that dust together until gravity could work its magic? Well, it looks like chondrules, these little glassy globes, helped the material that eventually became planets form. And one of my sources in the book says, you look at these little glassy beads in meteorites today, and they're the smallest humanly visible building block of the solar system. Pretty cool.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour, Focus 580, Christopher Coquinos, and we're talking about his book, The Fallen Sky. It's about meteorites, about what they are, where they come from, why scientists find them so interesting, and why so many people have just been fascinated to the point of obsession with them and collecting them and looking for them. It's a very interesting book. It's out now. Questions, welcome. And we are heading into about our last 10, 15 minutes. We have a number of callers here. People will really help us if they can be brief, and that way we can get in as many callers as possible. We'll go next to line 2 in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. The body that exploded over Siberia, when was it, 1901 or 2?
Right, 1908.
1908.
Yeah.
Now it's thought that it was a comet?
That's correct, yeah.
How big was it, and what would have been the effect if it had exploded over Central Europe or the Eastern United States?
Well, it would have been devastating. The caller's talking about the Tunguska explosion that was in 1908, an event, and we've been talking about impacts this morning. An event that size happens about every 500 years. I don't know how large the object itself was. I don't have that off the top of my head, but it was a comet, and it basically destroyed an entire area of Siberian forest. So it wasn't very populated, although the reports of what the shepherds and the peasants of that area went through are pretty harrowing. I mean, they were literally stunned, for 2 or 3 days. About 2,000 square kilometers of forest leveled by this thing. That's if I have my math right, that's about equivalent to 20 Manhattan Islands. So if that had hit a populated area, it would have been utterly devastating. One of the ironies of that explosion is that it colored the sunrises and sunsets beautifully. And you read the newspaper accounts of the day, this is again in 1908, and people are talking about what beautiful sunrises and sunsets we're having, what's causing them. And because the event took place in such an isolated area, it was a long time before scientists knew that there had been an impact from outer space, even though you had some evidence of that, a pressure wave that passed over the planet twice because of that event. At the same time, you know, we get these beautiful sunsets in 1908, beautiful sunrises. There's a mining engineer in Philadelphia who must have seen some of these, and he's obsessed with Meteor Crater in Arizona, wanting to prove that it had actually been formed by an impact and not some other calmer geological process. So I just love that image of this guy who's battling the scientific establishment of the time, saying, an impact caused Meteor Crater, an impact caused this. And he's looking up at a sunrise or a sunset in Philadelphia that's made, you know, just like a rainbow because of an impact that had taken place in Siberia.
Yeah, apparently there is a range for the estimate of the explosive force, but that clearly it would have been many times more powerful than the first atomic bomb.
Oh, very much so, yeah. I think 15 megatons is the force estimate for the Tunguska explosion. So again, you know, 20 New York cities basically would have been destroyed.
Yeah. Let's go on to another caller here, and this would be someone listening in Indiana on our line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm interested in two local, more or less local events. About 100 miles northeast of Champaign, near right at, outside of Kentland, Indiana, is a mine that they are mining in the edge of a huge crater.
Mm-hmm.
That was glaciated over so you don't see it. And I wonder if you know anything about that one. And one other one that I'm interested in is the Laurentide ice sheet almost 13,000 years ago. The claim is made that it was struck by some kind of extraterrestrial event.
Right.
And there are a large number of nano diamonds and buckyballs in those carbon buckyballs in those layers.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently that started the decline of the mammoths and also of the Clovis culture, Paleo-Indians.
Right.
And I'll take anything you have to say about that. I'll listen offline. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Great questions. I'm familiar with both of these. I don't really go into them in my book, but the Kentland question, I'm familiar with it, but I don't have any details. But what I would recommend to the caller and anyone who's interested in particular meteorite craters, whether they're visible on the surface like Meteor Crater or have been hidden because of glaciation, you know, and the terrestrial forces of erosion and sedimentation and so forth, there's a great reference book that's quite readable and even includes directions on, you know, how to visit these places called Meteorite Craters of the World. And it's by Paul Hodges. And so I'd recommend that book to anyone who wants to be sort of a meteorite crater tourist, because they are, you know, around, and you can, if not see them, you can know that you're standing on one. I visited one in Iowa, the Manson structure, which is, you know, under the farmlands of Iowa. But knowing, again, what's underneath there made that trip very cool. It's the same thing, you know, in a sense, as I was saying earlier about looking at meteorites. They're not visually often that striking, but if you know what you're holding, if you know what you're looking at, then it makes it pretty special. The other question was about the ice sheet being hit about 13,000 years ago. It's a controversial theory. There's still a lot of discussion going on about, you know, what did cause the decline of the mammoths and other fauna of that era and the Clovis culture. The caller mentioned buckyballs, which are a form of carbon. Those can also be caused by intense fires. So there's some backing and forthing on this, and I think the most recent issue of Sky and Telescope actually has a cover story on that particular controversy.
All right, let's talk next with someone in Urbana. Line 1, hello.
Oh, hi, how are you? Interesting subject, but also depressing at the same time. Could you speak about when the notion, I mean, we're quite aware now, we're in the scientific literature, about the idea of extinctions, mm-hmm. how many there have been, how long the Earth's been around. When did that sort of develop in people's minds where they thought, I mean, maybe post-Darwin, where you would think, oh, everything dies off and then there's renewal of life?
Yeah.
And also, I noticed recently something struck Jupiter about a month ago.
That's right.
And they didn't know what it was, and they never saw it. So, I mean, i.e. the NEAR program, you know, they're studying all these objects from the outer edges of the solar system. We're in between Jupiter and whatever it is, Uranus, that meteor belt. But so how accurate can they be to determine whether these things, where they are, how close they'll be, and that stuff like that? If they miss something, they'll have to, you know, what, a strike about the size of Earth on Jupiter.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll take my answer off air. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Well, let me take up the first or the last question first, and that is what hit Jupiter was apparently a comet about a mile wide. You know, you can see the effects. And so by seeing the effects on the planet, I believe one of the scars caused there was maybe planetary sized. So you know, you see these massive impacts happen. The second time that that we've seen Jupiter hit, I think, gosh, when the first one we saw was back in the 90s, Shoemaker-Levy 9. So we've talked about the rarity of these impacts in some ways, but now we've seen the biggest planet in the solar system hit twice in our lifetime. So we know these things are happening. There are difficulties in finding some of these objects. Asteroids that are very dark, as most of them are, right? Very, you know, hard to see, and perhaps very small in an eccentric orbit, can come out of nowhere and whiz right by. I mentioned in The Fallen Sky several instances of scientists seeing an object after it had passed close by. You know, so we're seeing it after the fact, and you know, little alteration in that orbit, and those objects would have hit. So, it is something again that kind of comes back to the need to survey and to be thorough about looking for these things. And the first question now I've lost.
I tell you what. Why don't we just say we have at least answered a couple, because I have one more person that I'd like to try
absolutely.
To do.
Sorry about that.
No, that's fine. Let's go to line number two. This is also Urbana. Hello.
How can I find the meteorites? Where should I look in the area? And what do I look for?
Oh, here's a young hunter in the making.
Awesome. Yeah, great question. Meteorite hunters talk about going to where they've been found before. So if you're just starting out as a meteorite hunter, I would say, well, first, get online, look at some of the websites of meteorite hunters, professional people who are actually physically going out in the field and bringing meteorites back for scientists and for profit and for selling. Jeff Notkin in Arizona has a wonderful website. He's one of the top hunters and dealers right now, and there's a group called the International Meteorite Collectors Association. Go to those websites, and you'll get lots of resources, okay, on how to do this. So I would start by going to those places where meteorites have fallen before and where you'd have then a better chance of finding them. That's a great way to start. And then, again, what you're looking for are rocks that are different from the rocks in the surrounding countryside. They tend to be magnetic. They tend to be heavier than Earth rocks of the same size. They tend to have these little depressions in them called thumbprints from the uneven melting, and they have fusion crusts, which is that dark brown or black surface. So you'll find lots of pictures in books and in online to help you, get started as a meteorite hunter.
I'm sure that we could find enough things to keep talking about so we could go another hour. Unfortunately, we don't have the other hour. We have a couple of minutes left. And, you know, one thing that I haven't given you the chance to talk about is some of the characters in the book, because that's a part of the story here is your profiles of some people who have become just, I think I've used the word a couple of times here, obsessed.
Totally.
Totally obsessed with meteorites. Jill, just, you know, give us a couple of minutes on one person.
Well, we're talking about going out and hunting them. I would also recommend to the young caller, take some geology classes as well. Harvey Nienegar is the central figure of my book, and he was an obscure biology professor in Kansas back in the 1920s. And he sees a fireball one night in November and decides he's going to hunt for meteorites. His first reaction after seeing that fireball is to bend over the sidewalk in McPherson, Kansas, and mark an X where he stood, because he realized that if he got enough reports of people who did basically the same thing, said, I was standing here and this is what I saw, he could triangulate those reports. He could calculate where the meteorites might have fallen. Now, he didn't actually find any meteorites from that fireball, but he went on, against the prevailing scientific wisdom of the day, he went on to collect hundreds, to amass a collection of thousands, to write about meteorites scientifically in ways that nobody had been writing about them, to popularize meteorites with the public. The previous caller was asking about extinction, and Harvey Nienegar was writing about rocks from space falling and potentially causing mass extinctions in the 1940s. 40 years before the dinosaur extinction studies came out in the 1980s. So this guy was a pioneering person, but he also took his family to the brink. I mean, he quit his job during the Depression. He quit his job, lost a vast amount of his income during the 1930s to hunt for meteorites, which was kind of a crazy thing to do, you know? But he made it work. And that obsession, that drive, that passion is in a lot of the characters I write about. And as you said, I mean, it becomes a part of my story as well. So I kind of weave together some aspects of my life in understanding the lives of these real historical characters.
Yeah, there were people who I'm sure had to put up with a lot of guff from friends, family, and others because of their passion. And it would be people are saying, look, they're just rocks.
Yeah, they're just rocks.
They're just rocks.
You know,
what's
and
the
you're
deal?
You're not going to find any of them.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, just as a kind of final question, I'm interested in you not having scientific training, but being a writer who really has made now a specialty of writing about science and nature and how that happened.
Well, it was a series of fortunate sort of accidents, I suppose. My dad, who lives in Indianapolis, worked for Eli Lilly for many years, was a chemist by training, and I think he instilled a love of science in me. As I joked with him recently, I said, you know, you gave me your love of science, but you didn't give me your math gene. So my math skills were never good enough to really get me beyond being interested in stuff. And I just sort of fell into thinking about extinct birds for Hope is the Thing with Feathers, because I'm a birder and was living in Kansas and learned that Carolina parakeets ranged into eastern Kansas. They would have been all over Illinois and Indiana. And so it was really because of stories that I became interested in some of these aspects of science and nature. And the stories of meteorite hunters really drew me into that subject as well. So The Fallen Sky is not really a guidebook. It's not a textbook. It is a kind of informal history of our understanding of rocks from space, but it's really told through stories, the stories of people like Harvey Nienegar and others.
And for people who are interested in trying to see some, maybe in action, I guess I would say, we certainly passed the Perseid, so if people didn't get that one, that one's gone. But there are a couple of other periodic showers, meteor showers, that do come up in the month of October, and early on and then maybe about the third week.
Yeah, absolutely. And, there too, I think, get online and look at Sky and Telescope has a great website, and it'll tell you when those meteor showers are taking place, when they'll peak and so forth. My favorite really is the Leonids in November.
Mm-hmm.
Every 33 years or so, you know, we get these big storms associated with the Leonids, and that's not going to happen this year, presumably. But they're big and they're bright and they're slow, and I just think they're a marvelous part of the autumn for me to watch that meteor shower.
All right. And if people want to read more about meteorites and the people who love them, the book is The Fallen Sky, An Intimate History of Shooting Stars by our guest Christopher Kokinos, published by Tarcher Penguin. He teaches English at Utah State. Thanks very much for talking with us.
No, it's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. Have a good day.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. This was a show we first broadcast August 29th of 2009. More archives available at our website, will.illinois.edu.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana. Support for today's broadcast comes from Trophy Time in Champaign. Trophy Time features a variety of advertising items, name badges, plaques, and trophies. They can also design and create unique awards for any occasion. Trophy Time, they're more than just trophies. More information is on their new website, trophytime.com.
And right now, we'll bring you an update on the numbers from Ag, and then we'll have more focus. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.